Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken, so to speak.
All right, episode 2 of season 3 of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Redcon 1, Balanced Body Labs, Old School Labs, and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. We are talking about the 1981 Mr. Olympia, and this is episode 2. And our guest today is John Balick. And many of you know John Balick as the owner of Iron Man magazine. John bought that magazine from Perry and Mabel Rader back in 1986. And I can't remember the exact date he sold it, but I think it was around 2015 or, yeah, about 2015. So John owned that magazine very long time. But before that, John was a photographer, and he was working for Joe Weider with Muscle Builder magazine and then Muscle and Fitness magazine. And before that, John was a competitor. He was from the Chicago area. He knew Bob Gaida very well and Sergio Oliva, and John was actually in the 1965 Mr. America contest, the IFBB Mr. America, that was held with the very first Mr. Olympia, where Larry Scott won the 1965 Mr. Olympia in New York City, one of the most famous contests ever. So John's going to talk a little bit about that and about his career in the sport. He was a good friend of Arnold Schwarzenegger back in the 1970s, and he was also around when they were filming the movie Pumping Iron. And then, of course, he was at the 1981 Mr. Olympia as a photographer for Joe Weider. So we're going to get John's input on that as well as his very, very long career. So it's going to be a great interview with John Balick. All right, and as I mentioned, we are brought to you by Redcon 1. Everybody wants to be a champion. Everyone wants to be the best. But at Redcon 1, they believe in working hard to achieve your goals. Whether it's to kill it in the gym or run a six-minute mile, Redcon 1 has something for those willing to put in the work. They have a premier clinically dosed pre-workout called Total War that is the perfect companion to your workout to give you that extra push to break through your mental and physical barriers. Then after the workout, you can fuel your body with the revolutionary MRE. It's the only whole food complete meal replacement with protein coming from salmon, chicken, beef, and eggs, and carbs coming from sweet potatoes and oats. And it also includes 10 grams of fat from MCT oil. It's the best tasting complete meal that you will ever have. So go to redcon1.com and try the very best sports nutrition has to offer. Redcon 1, the highest state of readiness. And as a favor to the show, you can enter the discount code LEGENDS and get 15% discount off your order. And we're also brought to you by Balanced Body Labs. If you're working hard to achieve your physical best, you need the optimum level of nutrients to reach peak performance. When your nutrients go missing, so does your ability to have a productive day. Balanced Body Labs has an easy-to-use at-home testing kit to help you detect your nutrient levels. They offer three different categories of tests, one for endurance athletes, one for those training for a competition, and one for those who are trying to lose weight. You just choose your test, take the sample test at home, you mail the test kit back, and then you log on for your results. They will test for your vitamin levels, your amino acids, your testosterone levels, your cortisol levels, and your lactic acid. No more going to a doctor's office and going through a painful blood test. Now you can just do it right at home. If you don't know what your nutrient levels are, you won't be able to perform at optimum levels, but Balanced Body Labs will help get you there. Just log on to balancedbodylabs.com and sign up for your easy-to-use at-home testing kit today. All right, this episode is being brought to you a couple days late because those of you who watch the news know that Florida went through a really, really bad hurricane, Hurricane Irma, and I have been now in Florida for 7 years, actually Sunday, the 10th, which was the day that the hurricane came through. That was my 7th anniversary. That was the day I moved here 7 years ago in 2010. So this was like my first hurricane in Florida, and a lot of people lost power, but really Tampa Bay really got lucky. The hurricane hit landfall around Naples. They got hit pretty hard, and then it went up north toward Tampa. So by the time it reached us, the wind had really died down, and I was very, very lucky myself because I had no damage to my condo, no flooding. I'm right where my condo is. I live right in the bay, right by the water. So I was expecting even if I don't get wind damage, I was going to get a lot of water damage and a lot of flooding. I spent all day on Saturday cleaning out my garage, moving everything upstairs because I figured I'm going to get at least 4 or 5 feet of water in my garage. And fortunately, we got nothing. I mean, no water, not even a puddle. A couple of the trees were, there was stuff knocked off the trees, but no damage at all. And I even had electricity. Most of Tampa right now, I'm recording this on Tuesday, about 3 days after the hurricane, but most of Tampa right now is without power. At least half the city is without power. In fact, I just got back from working out, and they had some power, but most of the lights were off. They had no air conditioning. And I just went to the store, and the store was without power. So a lot of people still don't have power, but I was lucky enough to have power. So I spent the hurricane at Powerhouse Gym Athletic Club out in Tampa. I work out with one of the owners, and him and his brother, Matt and Eddie, were both at the gym, and they let a few people crash there, so I was lucky enough to be there. And I got to, and Dave Bautista was there. Dave, who is a big movie star now, Guardians of the Galaxy, and he was in the James Bond movie. And Dave is a resident of Tampa, and he's a good friend of the owners of the gym, so Dave was also there. And I got to talk to Dave. He's starring in the new Blade Runner movie, which is coming out in October, and that looks really, really awesome. I'm a big movie fan myself, so it's always great to talk to Dave. He's a really, really cool guy, real laid back. And he told me about all the movies that he's got coming up. He is super, super busy. His career has really taken off in the last few years, and couldn't happen to a nicer guy. Such a great dude. And also, Dennis Newman was there, 1994 NPC Mr. USA, Dennis Newman, who unfortunately got leukemia right after he won that contest. And Dennis never really had a pro career. He still lives in California, but he was out in Tampa for a while visiting. And he's also friends of the owners of the gym. So Dennis was there. So I got to hang out with both Dave and Dennis and the owners of the gym. So it's kind of cool to hang out with some friends and not be at home, because I didn't want to be here when the hurricane went around. And this weekend is going to be a big weekend, because we've got the 2017 Mr. Olympia coming up out in Las Vegas. Phil Heath going for, I believe, his seventh Mr. Olympia win, where he will tie Arnold Schwarzenegger for total Mr. Olympia wins. And I think Phil is going to do it again. His win was so dominating last year. And even though there's some really good guys going on the show, I don't think anybody can beat Phil Heath. So I will not be out there, but I'll be following along. I think it's going to be on Amazon.com Live. So I'll be following along probably with a lot of you also. My hopes are with Cedric McMillan, who won the Arnold Classic this year. And I think Cedric has one of the best old-school-looking physiques of the current crop of pros. So I've always been a fan of Cedric ever since he first came on the pro scene. And I really, really hope he pulls it together. I think out of all the competitors, probably Cedric and Big Ramy have the best potential of unseating Phil Heath. But it's not just the physical attributes. You got to bring mentally also, and you got to knock out the champ. No one's ever done it just by casually going in there. You really got to go out and knock out the champ. It doesn't happen too often where the reigning Mr. Olympia gets beat by a competitor. So hopefully Cedric will have that eye of the tiger, and he'll really, really be hungry. And even if he doesn't win, if he could get it really close, and then maybe unseat Phil the next year. Who knows? So I'll be watching that online along with many of you to see what happens. All right, we are also brought to you by Old School Labs. With so many supplements on the market, it can be hard to know which brand is the right one. But as a three-time Natural Mr. Universe and Natural Mr. Olympia winner, the quality of supplements and knowing what I'm taking is very important to me, which is why we are giving you a 12% off your purchase at Old School Labs. So just go to oldschoollabs.com. and use the code LEGEND12 at your checkout. Old School Labs is the brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with, and Old School Labs is the brand that I personally use to win many of those competitions. So Old School Labs is a brand you can trust, and it values the golden era of bodybuilding. So we are happy to welcome them as a sponsor. For great results, keep it old school. And we're also brought to you by Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. They offer very competitive pricing along with their quality products and services. And those are just a few additional reasons to give them a try. So give them a call for more information and experience firsthand what sets Florida Alternative Medicine apart from the rest. So you can contact them at area code 813-922-8939 or email them at info@flalternativemeds.com. That's info@flalternativemeds.com. And you can use the promo code LEGEND and get a free consultation plus 20% off any packages. All right. So thank you again to Redcon One, Balanced Body Labs, Old School Labs, and Florida Alternative Medicine for sponsoring this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And here's our interview with John Balick, photographer and owner of Iron Man Magazine. Enjoy.
All right. Joining us from California is John Balick, the former owner of Iron Man Magazine. And John has had a very long, extensive history in the sport. He was around in the 1970s, a good friend of Arnold Schwarzenegger, and was a big part of the Muscle Beach scene. And of course, we're going to be talking about the contest, the 1981 Mr. Olympia, but I wanted to bring John on the show. And John, welcome to the show, first of all.
Great to be here, John. Kind of a full circle. We, Iron Man Magazine, I would say, was part of, you were a part of it for a long time, and we grew together at that point.
Yeah, it was a great experience for me writing for you, for your magazine. And I think it lasted about 14 years, and I grew up reading that magazine. So that was full circle for me, you know, to work for the magazine and work for you. And that was a great experience.
Well, it was mutual, you know, and that's how I got really involved with Ironman. I started training myself in eighth grade with a borrowed barbell from my uncle's in a friend of mine's basement.
Yeah.
And that was, and that story can be repeated thousands of times, maybe millions of times, by any 14-year-old discovering weights and the potential of the weight. So, yeah, at that point, I was a 100-pound, 5-foot-tall eighth grader.
Yeah.
So I had a long way to go. But I'll just, a lot of fortunate things that I, you know, right place at the right time. I met Bob Guider early on in Chicago. So I got in with, even though I was in school in Milwaukee at Marquette University, I spent, of course, summers in Chicago and weekends. And so I got to then meet Bob and Sergio Oliva in the very first month that Sergio was in Chicago.
Wow.
So that was a very auspicious thing for me. And of
what
course,
year was that, John, when Sergio was in Chicago for the first time?
I'm thinking that it's about 1963.
Okay.
I saw him at a Sayre Park weightlifting event.
Mm-hmm.
It was Sayre Park would have an outdoor weightlifting event each year in the summer. And Sergio was not participating. He was sitting towards the front of the outdoor space, complete with wearing a short sleeve white formal shirt that was split to the deltoid to fit his arm in. And of course, the trademark jewelry, which we all identified him with eventually. It was, you know, this is 50 plus years ago, and I can just remember him standing up probably to go to the bathroom or something, and just literally everything stopped, including the lifter on the platform, the
really?
Judges, and everybody in the audience, and all they did was kind of follow him out visually.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's an awesome story.
Yeah, so that led to, I graduated from college and always wanting to live in California. I moved there right on graduation. So that led me to be a charter member of Gold's Gym in 1965.
Wow.
And so that was when it was $40 a year. And, you know, and of course I met Joe Gold and Steve Marjanian and Seymour Koenig and Art Zeller and all of the people who were really the forerunners, the 50s guys.
Yeah.
That were, most of whom were on the beach and then segued into what was then the dungeon. I was never in the, you know, I was at the end of that era as Joe built the gym on Pacific. So it was, you know, as they say, we didn't know it, but it was the beginning of a real golden age.
Yeah. Well, that had to be amazing to be out there right at the beginning of Gold's Gym.
Yeah, it was like, you know, everybody moves to California for the same thing, the sun, the weights, and the women. And that was, and that's exactly what we had. That, you know, we had that glamorous feeling, even though Venice in 1965 was a backwater to say the least. You know, but Joe Gold built that gym from scratch himself. You know, and he and Szabo, and it was a 2,000 square foot concrete block building, essentially.
Amazing. And John, you were also, some people may not know this because they identify you as the owner of Iron Man Magazine, as photographer and, you know, writer for Weider earlier on in the 70s. but you were also a very good competitive bodybuilder. And I believe, weren't you in New York when Larry Scott won his first Olympia in 1965?
Yes. Again, that was just one of those things that brought me there. And again, that was, anybody that'll tell you that story, they'll say that it was an ovation and pandemonium second to none, because just because of the publicity and Larry's just that golden boy look he had. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, he was very, very heavily promoted within the Weider magazine. So it was a very, very fun, you know, fun time. And I was not a part of the New York scene at all. I was visiting somebody, so I don't have anything. I think I may have trained in Tommy Minichiello's gym while I was there or something, but that was the extent of my New York connection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my New York connection was mostly through the people at Goals who had moved from New York, the Art Zellers and the Seymour Konings, et cetera.
Yeah.
So it was a wonderful time, and Chet Yorton and people like that who were in the gym before even Arnold came. And I knew Chet from Milwaukee when I went to college there.
Oh, really?
He had come out. Yeah. So he had already won Mr. Wisconsin and, you know, and Mr. Milwaukee, and he had won everything in that area in Wisconsin before he moved out to the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
But I primarily competed in, you know, in the beach contest. I'd always been involved with what used to be the very small contest. You know, if we had 10 people in it, it was big. Today it's 100. So it's a totally different thing. And then I was a member of the AAU. I competed in the California and the Los Angeles multiple times before finally deciding that that wasn't going to go anywhere. I did it for the fun like everybody else did.
Mm-hmm.
But family obligations and things like that overtook that.
Now, when you competed in 1965, John, was that in the Mr. America? Because I think, what did they have, the Mr. America, Mr. World?
Yeah, that was the Mr. America contest. That was the only Mr. America. And I basically went in on a lark, of course. I knew I wasn't going to be competitive there. It was in Los Angeles, and there was no qualifying like there is today for a national contest. You know,
right.
You pay your money and you show up.
Did Dave Draper win that? He won the America that year, right?
You know, the year that I was in it, I think that was AAU, and I think that was Jeff Daniels.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think that was it. Draper won a Mr. America, but I think that was IFBB version of it.
Okay.
At that point. So anyway, that takes me into the beginning of the golden age at Gold's. And then, of course, when Arnold came on the scene, and Franco, that kind of transformed the place just because of their energy and, of course, their standing. But, you know, what made that time magic, and Art Zeller's photographs captured it very, very well. Artie was a great street photographer, and he spent a lot of weekends there to the point where he just became the fly on the wall. So the pictures had a completely unposed, spontaneous feel to them that's really not attainable anymore. And the other thing that's not attainable, if you look at the photographs, Frank Zane posing and Arnold and Franco and maybe Ken Waller or whoever was in the gym standing around and actually critiquing him as he poses.
Yeah.
You know, today, the last 20 years, this would never happen. And that was part of the magic. Gold's at that point had, say, 7 or 8 of the 10 best bodybuilders in the world training there at any one time. So it was a real, number one, the enthusiasm. But the other thing was that just there was a great sharing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the camaraderie was a great part of the scene.
Yeah, I seem to ask everybody this who's on the show, but what did you think of Arnold when you first met him? What were your impressions?
Well, you know, I actually the first time I actually met him was at Vince's, because when Joe Weider brought him out, he had him train at Vince's, because at that point Vince's was I'm going to say, maybe the go-to gym for Joe Weider. And actually, I had heard about him because, you know, at the Universe in Napa, he was really a sensation, the one that Chet Yorton won. Chet came back to the gym and said, "You got to see this. This is going to be the next great bodybuilder."
Oh, really?
And of course, this was the year before he came. I'd have to go take a look at what day Chet actually won the NABBA, but it was the year before Arnold really broke through.
Yeah.
But that was his big, Chet's big raving was when he came back, was this is going to be the next guy. And then I was actually, when Arnold must have been in 68, I was working for Vince. I had a regular 5-day-a-week job, but as an engineer, but on weekends I managed Vince's gym on Saturday and Sunday for Vince.
Oh, really? Okay. I didn't know you did.
Yeah. And Arnold came in and I was there, but so was Vince. And Vince was just sitting there. Arnold was, I don't know if you ever remember seeing that picture of Arnold, a side chest pose where it looked like you could put a, he was very young, but he's probably over 250 pounds.
Yeah.
And he had a side chest pose where his, I'm going to say his pectorals look like pot roast.
Right.
And that was the size that when he walked through the door. So he's on flip flops and a tank top and white shorts. And he walks in. He walks in, and Vince is sitting there as he sometimes did, chewing on an unlit cigar. And he came in and said, "I'm Arnold," with his total accent. He said, "I'm Arnold Schwarzenegger. I'm Mr. Universe." So it was obviously right after that time.
Right.
And Vince just put the cigar down, and he says, "You know, you just look like a fat fuck to me." And I'm standing there next to Vince, and I'm wondering how much of this Arnold actually understood because of his limited. But to me, one of the stories that goes along with that is that Arnold was never again that heavy.
Yeah.
And that was part of Arnold starting to understand the difference between quality and size.
Mm-hmm.
So as usual, Arnold didn't take it. He took it the way to his advantage. He used Vince's comment as maybe the guy's got a point.
Yeah.
And that was part of, I'm going to say part of Arnold's genius. He was always able to grow from experience, let's call it.
Did he get pissed off when Vince said that to him?
No. It was just kind of they had like a quizzical look on his face.
Uh-huh.
And I think he was, of course he knew that Joe Weider had recommended that he train there, but that was right at the beginning of when there was a transition towards the beach. That was kind of, I'm going to say at the end of Larry Scott and all of what that meant to Vince's gym.
Uh-huh.
And, and the momentum then moved to the beach.
Okay.
And with Arnold, et cetera. And that was, I'm going to say, the beginning of the really decline of Vince as the center of Southern California bodybuilding.
Yeah.
So that was my introduction to Arnold. And the next time I saw him, I was at Gold's Gym. So those were the typical. At that point, I lived quite a distance away from Gold's, so I would probably go to Gold's once a week.
Mm-hmm.
I go there on a Saturday or a Sunday because it was a 30 plus mile drive for me.
Oh, wow.
And,
okay.
So I didn't go there, on a daily basis.
How long did you work for Vince's gym?
It was probably less than a year. Right about that same time, I got into the food supplement business.
Okay.
And I started to, as a second business, to my regular engineering thing. And I started a little private label business that I eventually, I became Vince's supplier.
Okay.
So the supplements that he was selling in the gym were ones that I produced. And of course sold through Iron Man magazine.
Oh, really?
there were ads in there. The name of the company was called Scientific Nutrition.
Uh-huh.
It all grew out of wanting to get a better price on liver tablets. and I found out that if I bought 100,000 of them, I could buy them for one quarter of the price of retail.
Oh, okay. That was a supplement back then, right? Liver tablets. I remember taking those when I started.
Absolutely. They came in 100,000 with three boxes of 33,000. And I would sell off the 66,000 and more than pay for the supplements that I get for myself. That was the beginning of, my step into the sports nutrition world. And as you probably know, Bob Guido used to get the original Blair's protein from Ovaltine, the manufacturer in Chicago.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to ask you about Blair's protein because I know that was a big hit of the time, right?
That was a big thing. And Bob, Blair's protein was a private label. Blair's was a private label, but he had an exclusive use of it. And it was actually a product called OptiPro, which was a kind of a pharmacy protein.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you wouldn't hear about it unless the doctor told you about it. But Ovaltine made it. And Bob would literally go to, I think, I don't know, it was Villa Park. I'm trying to remember where exactly the Ovaltine plant was outside of Chicago.
Okay.
But the secret of the protein was that it was instantized. Now everything is instantized. But at that point in the process of making Ovaltine, they would come out with protein that they call them instantizing towers then, could actually also produce protein. But I believe that was in the early 60s, it was one of few in the entire country.
Hmm.
Now the process is everywhere. That's why everybody else's protein, when you would put it in, you know, when you would put it in something and mix it up, it would settle to the bottom like sand. Because that's what it was, whereas instantizing crystallized it and made the crystal much more soluble. So anyway, those were the... So through Bob Guida, I learned a lot about supplements,
mm-hmm.
and that led me to the product labeling for Vince and my own line, Scientific Nutrition, and I'm still involved with it, you know, 50 years later. Now the supplement manufacturers are, of course, many of the sponsors and booth buyers at the LA Fit Expo and our expo in Orange County, the two that I'm involved with. And I'm still involved with both of the expos here in California, in Southern California, I should say.
Okay.
So
yeah, I love it.
So that kind of, I know you mentioned you had Charles Gaines on and it really ticked my memory because I was two things. Number one, I was staying with Arnold, so that must have been 1974. I had moved away, but I had spent I was staying in Arnold's apartment building, and Charles Gaines and George Butler were talking to Arnold. I mean, we were literally sitting on the floor of his living room, sprawled out, and we're all discussing what was to become Pumping Iron. Now, you know, I had spent most of my life up to that point, I'm going to call it on a soapbox, being an evangelist for bodybuilding.
Okay.
And I had never been able to have any kind of a breakthrough with the larger public.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you one quick story. Back to 1966 or 67, when the Mr. America was in Columbus, Ohio, Bob was the Mr. America. Bob had it with Mr. America before, so I think it was 66. And then he was going to be handing out the trophy for the following year. And I spent most of the weekend with a writer from Sports Illustrated. And I mean, literally talked 12 hours about bodybuilding and weightlifting and et cetera, et cetera. They had two photographers there.
Hmm.
I mean, they covered it like a blanket. And of course, nothing was ever printed.
They never put it in there. They never put it in the magazine.
They never put it in the Sports Illustrated. It took, of course, another 10 years before Sports Illustrated would do anything on bodybuilding, and that was Arnold.
Yeah.
But I was tell you that prelude because I'm sitting on the floor with Charles Gaines and George Butler. I had no idea about their connections within publishing and the whole New York art scene and all of these other things. But I'm thinking these guys are, you know, should I tell them that they're barking up the wrong tree because nobody's going to care?
They're dreaming.
but obviously, I'm going to say this: it took a pair of outsiders, really, to transform bodybuilding.
Have you seen the book yet, John? Book Pumping Iron.
Have I seen the book?
No. Did you, at that point had you already seen the book? Or
No. There was no book. They were talking about the book.
Okay.
This is before the movie. I mean, before everything, because obviously the movie was 75.
Yeah.
So that was part of the, obviously I got to know them when Arnold, like Roger, I was in New York for the you know, for the showing at the museum and the posing there. And and that was, in fact, the first limo ride I ever had. It was with, it was with Arnold and the director of Stay Hungry.
Bob Rafelson.
Bob Rafelson, you know, and of course, Bob Rafelson was asking me about Arnold, and the three of us were in the back seats, and he said, he says, I'm going to make Arnold a star. And of course, in my mind, Arnold was already a star, but I didn't, he was in a different context. And of course, that led to being an extra in Stay Hungry in Alabama, you know, whatever it was, a year, 2 years later, I guess is really when it was. And so that was another unbelievably fun time. And the pictures from there are, you know, the group shot that's all around the web. That's a shot that I took.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. And many more that aren't on there. But this, and that, of course, brings up another, I'm going to say, comment of mine. Many people, and maybe you included, have said that the art of photography over all of the years is what put, you know, what we see today and what really put bodybuilding on the map.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we see these photographs that are used all of the time, and there is never, there's never any attribution. I mean, I see Art Zeller, you know, I see Art Zeller and I see Russ Warner. I see all people that I've known and some that I haven't, never met, Lanza and all of the other guys. I recognize the photographs, but, you know, the younger generation thinks that these things just happen by accident.
Yeah.
But they didn't, just like pumping iron didn't happen by accident, et cetera. Mm-hmm. You know, in other words, it took vision, it took skill. And I would really like to see somehow when pictures are used, most of the people that are at least using them, and I'm going to say in your age group and above, recognize who took them.
Yeah.
You know who the source was. I would like to see some attribution, at least. I know that, you know, the way this is set up today, everybody takes whatever they need, and that's in some ways depreciates it. But, you know, back to the, you know, all through the 70s, I did freelance work for Weider, and eventually in 79, I got out of the food supplement directly and engineering business altogether. And I set up a photo studio in Venice in 1979.
Hmm.
So that was, and that of course, at that point, Joe was using more studio photography rather than just the outdoor stuff that Artie Zeller would shoot.
Yeah.
So, and Artie was not interested in studio photography whatsoever. He was I'm going to call him a street photographer, a great photographer on all aspects, technical and aesthetic. But studio was not his interest. So at that point, if I were going to find myself a niche here, I needed to move into building a studio, which is what I did and what I learned.
And how did you learn how to be a photographer, John?
By taking a lot of pictures and... Uh-huh. You know, Art Zeller was a great mentor. I mean, he was, I'm going to call him brutally honest, but a lifelong friend and somebody who I learned a huge amount of light, shadow, exposure, you know, all of the technical parts of it.
Yeah.
And the other part was, I think it helped that, you know, I was a competitor. I was a fairly good poser myself.
Mm-hmm.
I had a feeling for the human body. I was always interested in anatomy and kinesiology. So that was part of it. The other, I literally looked at pictures of Jimmy Caruso and I said, how did he do this?
Hmm.
You know, I mean, that's where I started. I literally took pictures to photo supply stores in Hollywood that sold the lights and all the stuff that you need to do it.
Yeah.
And I said, what do I need to do this? Literally, I mean, I've never taken a photography class in my life.
Right.
But that's how I learned. I learned by doing it. I secondarily in 1979, late 79, I met Mike Nebu. who is number one, a trained photographer, but more than that, you know, is in a whole other world. He elevated photography completely in bodybuilding that no one has ever seen before.
Right.
So he was the first one to shoot close-ups and all of the things. Just a revolutionary eye as far as studio and contest photography. So I learned from him, and he was very generous. He's never somebody that was all secrets, like some people might be.
I remember those pictures you took of Arnold and Ed Corning. I think it was the year, I think it was in 75 when he was training, when they were both training for the Olympia. I think you wrote a little article about it. You said Arnold was just getting over a cold or something and might have been a little bit down in weight, and you took those pictures of him on the beach, and every shot was just fantastic. And you can still see those shots today. I still see them all over the internet and stuff.
And just lately, I resurrected the original negatives here, and I've done some scanning of those negatives.
Oh, really?
And, you know, and yes, and the funny thing was, that was 1975, of course, before pumping iron. I was there for 6 weeks in the summer, but I did not go to South Africa. And when they were shooting pumping iron, if you saw Arnold and Ed squatting, for instance, in the rack in the corner, it was actually a three-person rotation. I was the third person, but I was never in.
Oh, really?
Iron. Yeah,
because,
so the three of us, right, that six-week period, I was at Arnold's house. And but one of the crazy things about that summer, and it had been like overcast as it can be in California in the summertime at the beach, like low-level fog, for all of July, and we were getting into August. That was one of the first clear days that on the beach there in 4 or 5 weeks.
Okay.
So it was a very serendipitous time, and the light was such that it gave that very, very, you know, etched feel to the pictures.
Yeah.
You know, so there, that was a lot of things came together there. But yes, you were right. It was, you know, Arnold was, to me, Arnold was probably at his best in 74. You know, when he won at Metis at the Felt Forum.
Yeah.
And you know, my pictures on Muscle Rock and the picture, the one that was on the Education of a Bodybuilder cover, that was all, those were all taken in 74. And Arnold was, I'm going to say, noticeably bigger.
Yeah.
You know, and to me, you know, so I again, you know, that was, he was always fantastic, you know, just a version, because you look at his waist there in 75, and I mean, you know, his waist was almost non-existent.
Yeah, I mean, those pictures are amazing, because he's just standing relaxed, and he just looks perfect, you know?
Yep, yeah, those were the days, as they said. Unfortunately, I didn't take enough pictures.
Tell us a little bit about your relationship with Arnold, John, because I know when you had Iron Man magazine, you would write a lot of editorials, and you would, you know, mention Arnold, you had mentioned his mindset, his determination, how he set goals, how he thought of things. So you were really in a unique position because you got to know him really well. And I know there was a time when you guys were even doing seminars together. And then, like you said, you got to live with him. So tell us a little bit about your thoughts of Arnold, especially then when he was at his prime.
Well, you know, at his prime, well, I'm going to say he's always been at his prime, but there's been different kinds of prime.
Yeah, that's true.
Arnold was just so much more than a bodybuilder. I mean, in other words, that was apparent to anybody who talked to him, talked to him. So he was always, he always had a reason for why he did something. You know, how he turned his hands, how he did the exercise, how he, if when I was staying at his house, I'd say, well, why don't we have like, you know, a dumbbell set and some benches and things at the, you know, in the garage. You know, we got this big garage. We did, you know, we could do in between workouts. We didn't have to, you know, drive to the gym. And he says, the gym is, the home is to relax. The gym is to work out. And that was all he needed to say. I mean, in other words, he didn't go like, oh, I don't feel like it. He had a reason.
Yeah.
And the reason is, as he said, he didn't want to mix the two. The other thing, you know, especially in 75, that's where I spent the most continuous time with him, which was around 6 weeks.
Okay.
at the end there working out twice a day. When he left the gym, almost everybody else that worked out would rehash the workout. You know, they would talk about the workout. They would do this. Arnold moved on. There was never any talk about what happened in the workout, whatever it is. It's really, if you move forward and go to Arnold's office today, you'll see that there's one thing on his desk. It's the one thing he's working on.
Hmm.
So I'm going to say 35 years later, 40 years later almost, it's exactly the way he was.
Wow. Hmm.
One at a time, laser focus.
Yeah.
No distractions. So that was it. I mean, he was, you know, I think I've rehashed most of them in editorials over time, but that's just an example that runs through everything he did.
Yeah.
When he did it, it was 110% focus.
Mm-hmm.
When it was done, it was gone.
Yeah.
You know, so that, and it's a damn difficult thing to do as I sit here in front of my desk with 12 things on it.
Right.
You know, but he has been able to do that. When he was governor, you know, I spent a full 12-hour day with him when he was governor that was just easily as exciting as any 12-hour day I ever had with him as a bodybuilder.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. Whole nother story.
Yeah.
that was 12 hours and 500 photographs.
Yeah.
But anyway, let's, you know, we'll move on beyond that, you know, staying in Alabama for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Arnold got all of his friends down there. I mean, to me, one of the real special stories there, and unfortunately I was standing next to Arnold, Robbie Robinson had not done well in the contest that he thought he wanted, that he should have. I can't remember if that was AAU America then or what it was. But anyway, Robbie was on the way back to Florida.
Okay.
And Arnold said, stop in Alabama and spend some time. So he came down there and Arnold said to him, because Robbie was ready to give up and go back to pumping gas.
Wow, really?
And Arnold said to him, don't do that. You've got the potential to be Mr. Olympia in 3 years.
Hmm.
And while he was never Mr. Olympia, he sure became a way better bodybuilder than he was at that point.
Yeah.
And in fact, so Arnold was, you know, again, you know, people sometimes say some things about Arnold that he's not thinking of others, but he, at this point, he definitely, you know, and I've seen him give advice like this unsolicited to people before that was really important to the person and as encouragement, et cetera. So he really, I'm going to say, turned Robbie around to where Robbie is 40 years later.
Yeah. Yeah. Became a bodybuilding legend.
Absolutely. So that was, you know, there were many little stories, you know, from being in Alabama there. And I'll just go through one before we move to 1981.
Okay.
I don't know if you remember, but in Stay Hungry, there was a shot in a parking garage where all of the guys were posing in spaces.
Mm-hmm.
Like they were standing on a ledge.
Mm-hmm.
And posing, you know, like, I know, six or eight guys up there, and it was like a long shot, but you could see all the bodybuilders posing at various levels in the parking garage.
Okay.
And I was not one of them. I was standing next to Bob Rafelson and the cinematographer down below.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And the cinematographer goes, Franco, these guys are standing on like a 12-inch ledge, fourth floor. And the cinematographer says to Bob Rafelson, Franco has his shoes on. So they get on the bullhorn and they say, Franco, take off your shoes. Franco is standing there, bends over, and on one foot, he's taking off his shoes. Bob Ravelson goes to the cinematographer. He says, "Do we have insurance for this?"
Wow.
Anyway, that's my last story from there. The 1981 Mr. Olympia in Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah. Were you at the 1980 Mr. Olympia, John?
Yes.
Oh, you were. Okay.
I've only missed Essen, Germany, South Africa, and Rimini. So of them, I've missed three.
Okay.
I think only Albert Brusek has seen more than me, as far as I know there.
Yeah. Because
I think he saw all three of those. Anyway, yeah, I mean, it was, Columbus was, of course, Columbus is, you know, always, it was always a special place because it was Columbus.
Yeah, and I agree.
And you knew Jim Lorimer was going to fill that 4,200 seats or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and Jim, the consummate promoter that he was. But anyway, it was obviously a very exciting thing. I knew Danny. Danny was a very close friend of mine. I wrote and photographed the training courses that he did. I was there in Nîmes when he won the Mr. Universe contest, and couldn't wait to get home. He had a ticket, but he wanted to go right now, so I put his ticket on my credit card so he could get home that day, literally.
Oh, really?
So we were very close friends. You know, terrific guy. To me, one of the most genetically gifted people I've ever seen in my 50 years around this.
Yeah.
And when I saw Danny in the condition he was in, I said to somebody, and it was cold, as it sometimes is in Columbus, and he was in an overcoat. I said, and I could tell by his drawn face.
Yeah.
I said the only thing that's the same is his voice.
Yeah. When he walked out, when I was there at the prejudging, I didn't even recognize him at first because his face looked completely different. I never saw it so sunk in.
Right. Well, he finally did. You know, I'm going to say he finally fulfilled his promise.
Yeah.
You know, he was always, you know, anyway, he was one of the great bodybuilders and one of the great guys in bodybuilding.
You were living in California that year. And
correct.
A lot of people, I'm sure there's a lot of rumors going around, like, you know, a lot of people were going to boycott that contest because of what happened in Sydney. So did you see a lot of these guys in the gym training, like, I think Roy Callender, he was out in California, right, that summer, and of course Platt,
yeah.
And a lot of the guys who really came in spectacular condition. Did you see them in the gym as the months were getting closer to the contest?
Yeah, I shot most of those people.
Okay.
I did not shoot Danny in that condition. My recollection was that he had gone home and trained. I don't think he trained in California for that.
Yeah, okay.
I wouldn't have been so shocked by his condition if I would have been seeing him.
Right.
So I'm thinking that he went home, and I know that, you know, he and Ed Corney would train together, you know, multiple years. And then it was really up to then people, you know, Joe Weider to underwrite the cost of these things. Because you know, these guys would be staying out here, you know, 6 or 8 weeks, you know, and they weren't working.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm talking about Ed or either of these guys. So, you know, anyway, what I thought. Danny, way more perfect than anybody I had, any version of him I had ever seen.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to say I went there with a jaundiced eye when I saw him, in the sense that I was immediately, you know, he immediately caught my eye, and in my mind, he would be the winner.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, everybody subsequent, it's hard to, I mean, I've literally in the last week looked at the group shots here.
Okay.
You know, I mean, his waist must have been 28.
Right.
If it was that. You know, and then you had Roy Callender, you know, and people like that who were huge and thick. Now, as great a bodybuilder as Roy was, he just doesn't have the physical perfection of Danny.
Right.
As far as the connections, et cetera. And anything I say critical of the physique is, you know, separate from the person. You know, in other words, I respect each one of these guys, but, and my judging criteria may not be somebody else's. I was always one who put, I learned this from Bob Guida, deltoids, waist, and calves. That's what defined the proportion. And so proportion is first.
Right.
And that day, deltoid, waist, and calves was Danny's day.
Mm-hmm. But, what did you think about Tom Flats when he came out at the prejudging?
You know, I mean, again, I mean, Tom Platz was a special character, you know, and I'm going to say, you know, it has nothing to do with proportion. He was a great showman,
mm-hmm.
you know, thighs, et cetera, you know, second to none. Another just terrific guy. You know, I shot him many times and knew him personally very well. Again, if I look at that top five, Danny's proportional perfection for my values is, I would put him number one.
Now, did you feel that way right after the prejudging was over, John?
I'm thinking that I did.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, we're talking about, you know, almost 40 years ago here.
Yeah.
35 years, 36. It's hard to, you know, as I say, my emotions that day, and I'm going to say it was emotional for me. I wasn't sitting there to be a dispassionate judge.
Yeah.
In other words, I'm coming there with a different view, almost. And I, you know, Artie Zeller would say, who's the winner? He says, the winner is the physique I would like to have.
Right.
You know, not, you know, does that mean, you know, the biggest, et cetera, et cetera. You know, to me, bodybuilding has lost its way, but that's a whole other story.
Right.
So do I place the rest of them? How would I put, what would I do with Franco and Roy, et cetera, and Tom?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
To be honest with you, I'm not clear on that.
Okay.
You know, just simply, you know, in other words, he would be my winner for all of the things that I just said. Now, other people said, what are you, out of your mind? He was way too, Roy Callender, et cetera, would just dwarfed him.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I'm going to quote Art Zeller again. He says, you know, bodybuilding is a sport of opinion.
Yeah.
And that's why we get some wildly changing things. If you pick Franco because of his powerful look, you know, but his thighs were deficient, and Danny, somebody would say that his thighs were deficient, and Callender that his legs weren't balanced, and Tom is dominated by his thighs.
Yeah. You know? Right.
So you got this melting pot, and of course, as Arnold would say at that level, he said this in the gym, it isn't what you have, it's what you don't have.
Right. Well, the reason I asked that, John, is to make it sound like you were there almost as a fan. You know, you weren't a judge, as you said. I was there at the prejudging, and those crowds in Columbus were so loud, and they were so vocal, and they did so many different comparisons. And I remember, you know, the sting of Sydney, I guess you could call it, was still in the air because people were remembering what happened. And then I think everybody in the auditorium felt it was, you know, Danny, Tom, and Roy at the top. And, mm-hmm. Franco and Chris Dickerson were probably going to be behind them. Franco because of the legs. But there were so many different comparisons, and the crowd was going crazy. And that's why I asked you, you know, what you thought after the prejudging was over. Because like you said, it's 35 years later. We can look at the pictures now and analyze it, and Danny does look perfect. But, you know, when they had those comparisons, I remember the crowd was really blown away by Flats because he made so much improvements in the upper body, I think. And then he had those leg shots next to Franco, you know.
Right. Yeah, obviously there was no comparison there. You know, I mean, Tom was dominated, dominating by his legs and dominated by his legs, you know.
Right.
You know, so of course you were right. I mean, we have never heard crowds like the 70s and early 80s mm-hmm. in Columbus. Nowhere.
Yeah.
Today's Mr. Olympia, the crowd, there is nothing compared to the crowd, crowd reactions.
Right. It was amazing back then.
You know, 77 when Ed Corney, when Pumping Iron mm-hmm. was out, and he started to rotate on that platform, and this 175-pound guy, I mean, Mike and I stopped taking pictures and turned around and looked at the audience because it felt like you were in 10-foot surf.
Yeah.
You know, and it was breaking over the top of you.
Yeah.
Today we got bodybuilders 100 pounds heavier at almost the same height.
Right.
And people are barely applauding because, for me, there's no connection between the people on stage and the people in the audience.
Yeah, I remember I was there in 77 also. I was sitting in the balcony, and I was looking down. It was like the flash bulbs, you know, below me were just going crazy. And I think he got like 2 standing ovations, didn't he, at Corny that night?
Yeah, I mean, it was just, you know, and when you look back at that, you know, how is that? That was when bodybuilding was art and emotional.
Yeah, yep. That's a good way to put it, art and emotion.
I don't know, they're just, you know, it's been, I'm going to say, just changed to the point where it isn't what it was for multiple reasons. Posing is just one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, each one of these guys, you named the top 5 there in 81, talk mm-hmm. about 5 different personalities.
Yeah.
And the personality showed in the posing and the stage presence and all of that. So there was not, you know, and talk about a disparity of genetic type. We'll put Danny at the top of the perfect mesomorph.
Right, right.
You know, and we'll put Roy at the top of ultra muscular. And each one of them was an engaging personality.
Yeah.
I think that's part of it. And, you know, and I think even the fans, either through the magazine and just, you know, just through general interaction, definitely they felt that.
Yeah. I talked to, we had a conversation with Roger Schwab, and he said the same thing. He said he felt like when these guys came out there, it's like, you knew him. I guess because of the connection to the magazine and stuff.
Well, see, I mean, the advantage of having so few guys was that you were able to go in depth mm-hmm. in the magazine. I mean, if you look at Robbie Robinson in the, you know, after Arnold talked to him, 78, 79, I mean, he dominated Muscle and Fitness.
Yeah.
I mean, he was in every issue. As he should be. He was a dominant character. You know, that was all there was to it. You know, there was a lot. Anyway, each one of these people that we've mentioned here were special characters. Each one of them, there wasn't, you know, they were competitive, but I'm going to say, to use a word that's thrown about today, not mean-spirited in any way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they still felt as part of a club.
Yeah.
You know, there was a general camaraderie among people, and that was what made that time so special, and it's irretrievable today.
Yeah. And you mentioned also, you just mentioned the magazines, and that made me think of, you know, you're talking about staying with Arnold for those 6 weeks, and he was training with Ed Corny. And I remember in Muscle Builder around that time in 1975, or it might have come out in 76, they had a long interview with Ed Corny, and he was really talking about, like you just were, about how Arnold thought about things and how he, you know, his mental attitude was, how he set goals for himself. And you could tell Ed was really affected by his relationship with Arnold, training with him that year for the Olympia, and how it really changed him for the better because he got to really learn from Arnold. And you don't see that. I mean, well, of course, we don't see much in the magazines at all anymore, but back then, they had long articles, and they would really get in depth with these people and have long conversations. And I really love that about those early magazines from Muscle Builder and Iron Man and from that era.
Well, the big advantage is that there were so few people
mm-hmm.
that the genetic pool. I mean, today, you know, I look at the top 15 in the, say, the Mr. Olympia, and half of the people, because I'm not totally immersed in it, I have no idea who they are.
Yeah.
You know, so, and neither do the fans.
No. I mean, how can you keep up with it? You know, there's so many, and there's no coverage.
In some ways, you know, this internet, you know, has made everybody into their own marketing machine.
Yeah.
But there isn't connection. Just everybody is separate.
Yeah. I agree.
You know, you look at that picture from that I took in Alabama, or even further back, the 1968 picture that was taken in a sound stage there. I don't know if you know that one. I was sitting in the front row. Arnold was there, probably 69. Boyer Coe was there. There were 50 mm-hmm. people in the room. Anybody who was anybody in bodybuilding was in that room. And why were they there? They were there for only one reason. It was the first time Boyer Coe posed in Southern California. Nobody had ever seen him live.
Mm.
My idea was to get everybody together and give Boyer a little welcoming party.
Wow.
So that's who was there. I mean, it was Arnold and Franco and Frank Zane and Joe Nista. And I mean, you go through that crowd there, Dave Draper, there wasn't anybody what's his name?
Yeah, yeah.
If he was in Southern California, and why were they there? Mm-hmm. They were there to. I'm going to say, get together and honor Boyer Coe.
God, that's amazing. That's amazing today when you think about something like that.
Yeah, I mean, and everybody was cordial and it was fun, you know. And in other words, there was an excitement to see this guy on stage.
Yeah, yeah. Talk about support from your fellow athletes, you know.
You know. So anyway, I'm going to say the good thing was serendipitously I was in the right place. At
yeah.
the right time.
Yeah.
and that's about all there is to it. Or, you know, there isn't anything that I planned along the way here.
Yeah.
Timing-wise, it was just my own, you know, as I've said to Bill Grant, and actually in the 60s, Bill spent, I don't know, a month or two living at my house in the Hollywood Hills.
Mm-hmm.
I said, we're all connected by the confraternity of the barbell.
Mm-hmm.
Our own personal obsession with this thing. Most of the time when I trained with Bob Guida, you know, Bob and I were the only, quote, two non-minority people in the room in Chicago, where those
yeah.
two YMCAs are.
Uh-huh.
Was there anything other than fun in all those hours?
Hmm.
No. There
yeah.
was no... You know, there was no confrontations. There was no anything. There was just laughter.
Yeah.
And people spotting each other.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, bodybuilding has pulled together many different pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Color-wise, sexual orientation-wise. I mean, bodybuilding was more accepted of people that were different than them.
Mm-hmm.
40 years before it's become in vogue.
Yeah.
And I believe it's just simply that, you know, you share my obsession, that makes you one of us, whatever
yeah.
us is.
Right.
You know, whatever us is.
They'll share the passion of the barbell, like you said.
Yeah. So, you know, to me, that's one, and I'm going to go one step back. A lot of this has to do with Ben and Joe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, both of them were absolutely colorblind.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, at 180 degrees away from Bob Hoffman in that era.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe was always that way. And in fact, the beginnings of the IFBB were really, if you look at the people from the early 60s, those are all the people that, quote, couldn't win in the AAU because they weren't the right color or the right religion or the right whatever it was that Hoffman needed.
Right.
So those were, to me, you know, I mean, Joe and Ben were instrumental in this whole revolution, but they were also two special guys
mm-hmm.
in their obsession, you know, was all encompassing.
Right.
Anyway, I'm going to start losing my voice if I go on any further.
John, let's talk a little bit more about that 81 Olympia. So what was your feelings then when it was all over? Because we just talked to Roger Schwab for a second interview, and we were talking, because Roger was the head judge that night, and we were talking about the scoring system and how they were using the point system, and how we went through the judges' scores one by one, and there were so many judges that were giving Franco 20 points, probably because he was Franco, and that's what ended up happening where he won. So Roger said he talked to you at the beginning of the night show, and you were all excited about the show, and he sort of knew what was going to happen because he saw the scores, but he didn't say anything. So when they had those final placements, what were you thinking? What was your reaction? Because that had to be one of the most controversial Mr. Olympias ever.
Without question. And again, I'm just going to go back and say it was really a turning point for Danny, and he was never that.
Yes.
You know, never that way again.
Mm-hmm.
And which is unfortunate.
Yeah, very unfortunate.
Again, in other words, Roger, I don't remember ever even seeing the score sheets. I may have seen them afterwards, but I don't have any recollection of that whatsoever, so I don't know where the scores are. But again, I'm going to go back and say that Danny would have been my winner because of all the things that I just said.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why at the other end, you know, when these things happen, and we've seen this happen in the Olympia over and over and over again. You know, as Mike Nevius says, Olympias, they don't get beaten. They either die or retire.
Right.
You know, because it's like boxing. Up against a champ, you have to knock him out.
Mm-hmm.
You can't win on points.
Yeah.
You know, because just as you said, Franco is Franco. Now, I wasn't coming from that direction. Franco's a great friend, one of maybe the strongest guy I have ever seen pound for pound.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 500-pound touch-and-go bench presses, lift off himself, weighing 180.
Jesus.
You know, 700-pound deadlifts for multiple reps without straps.
Wow.
You know, I'm going to say hands like talons. So Franco is just in another world strength-wise from almost any bodybuilder, or even power lifter for that matter. And he was, especially at that body weight. But so there's very much to admire about Franco and his gifts. But, you know, I would say if I were a judge, and I wasn't, I would go with Danny. How the other judges judged it across the line, Roger, of course, was on the front line there. So he would have a much better view of that than me. So, you know, the audience had their favorites, as you said.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, with the audience, it could have been Tom Platz.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or Roy.
Or Roy or Danny. You know, I think the audience, I would say 80% of that audience felt those are the top three for sure.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm not, you know, I don't have anything else to add beyond that because I don't have any idea, you know, how various judges scored. And Roger, I didn't listen to Roger's podcast, so I don't know what he even said. But I'll get back to that, and I especially want to listen to the Charles Gaines.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
I haven't actually spoken with Charles since Alabama, whereas George Butler I've spoken to in the last couple of years, and George came out here multiple times over the last 30 years, and actually I did interviews with him about the history because he was going to do something and then never did, as far as
okay.
I know.
Okay.
You know, but you know, both of them were outsiders with a vision that changed the world, our world.
Yeah, and they did. Yeah.
So that's all. That's about the only comments I can make on 81. And they come with all of the caveats that I just told you.
How did you feel walking out of there, John, after that, you know, when the crowd went nuts, when they announced that top five?
I mean, surprisingly, not surprisingly, but especially as a photographer, and I'm going to say a fan and a friend, I'm all three of those things of everybody on stage because I know them all personally.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, that's different than almost anybody else in the audience. And what it takes to photograph a 3-hour show, especially in those days when you had film and it was way, 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 way more complex than it is today.
Right.
You know, there were many different, it took a lot of, I'm going to say, Arnold's kind of focus to not make mistakes, catch the right moments. And in fact, after most of those, and not even particularly this one, there's a certain like almost postpartum depression from it. You know, you just get, you focus all your energy into it and all of a sudden it's gone.
Yeah.
You know, so there is that aspect of it. And then, of course, you then relive it as you, you know, as you develop your 50 rolls of film and edit it. But, you know, that's usually much less emotional. I mean, you got mm-hmm. all the power of the audience and all that, and it all just drains away. I don't know how you felt then, but I felt drained in my recollection.
Yeah. Yeah, I can still remember it to this day. It was like it took place a month ago because, you know, it was such a memorable contest.
One of the great ones of all time. And if you were there for the 77 with Corny on stage,
yeah,
you got a moment that has never been duplicated. The closest that would be Larry Scott in 65.
Great.
And that was a much, much smaller room.
Oh, really?
But okay. Brooklyn Academy was like, maybe I'd have to go look on that line, but it seems to me like it's 2,000 seats.
Right.
It's half the size of this.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You know, and unfortunately, the Veterans Memorial Columbus was one of the great auditoriums in the United States for bodybuilding. I mean, all uninterrupted sight lines on a beautiful, huge stage. You know, it had everything. And, you know, and now we watch the Mr. Olympia on our, you know, on
our
flat floor. And a cavernous room, which, even though the crowds may be bigger, it just absorbs them.
Right. Yeah, I've never been more sorry when a building got torn down than when they tore that Veterans Memorial down.
Yeah, it ended up that I think Jim's contest was the only... You know, was the only event.
Yeah, I know. That was all they had there. Yeah.
You know, I mean, so you couldn't keep it going on just the one.
I know. But it was a shame to see it go because it's such history for the bodybuilding. Okay, John, I appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule to talk to us. Man, you had some fantastic stories. I know you, like you said, you were in the right place at the right time, and you really shared some of the, or you really were there for some.